So this evening, the title of the talk is very simple, The Way Things Seem to Be. And I'd like to kind of, my intention here is to try and fit this into our life, rather than something we go out of life in order to go in this kind of bubble of a retreat. And then, how does it work? Where are the meeting points? And I want to share with you a very touching event that happened. You hear me okay back there? Great. Event that happened. I've been doing Zoom group every Friday for nearly 2 years. It's about like 90 meetings or something like that. And there was one young guy there who was really involved and asking questions and so on. And he was, you know, with us at least 40 of those meetings. And in Zoom, you know, you only see faces, right? So he was happy and engaged and asking good questions and meditating on. Only after 40 meetings did we all discover that he was sitting in a wheelchair. And of course, wow. And he shared that he had an accident in somewhere, maybe a car accident, or young, healthy guy, and he had 2 years of rehabilitation and so on, and 2 years of anger and rage and distress and misery. And at a certain point, he just knew he couldn't live like that anymore, with that level of misery. And it took 2 years, but the Dharma really helped him. I don't say it's the only Dharma. I'm not saying that it's a one-to-one. If you meditate, then things can change radically. They can, but there are other things too. But it was so beautiful to see what's possible. And he didn't say a word until we'd been 40 times together. We kind of build an assumption in our life, hanacha, a kind of a basic, this is life, we keep coming to that place. Life is about coping, hitmodudut, it's about getting it right. There's full of difficulties and but my task in life is to kind of navigate through the difficulties. And now and then we can feel, if that's all my life is, then some meaning is missing. Something is missing from that model. That I'm born and navigate through life, because of the navet, so that things are better and I am happier. And that's it. So some little voice behind says, maybe that's not it. And what the key is that we experience things and then we build a picture from those things, and we call that reality. So we experience here, I mean, a few comments I've had in the groups and meetings with you. I'm bored. Nothing's happening. I've got lots of nuisance thoughts that disturb me all the time. It's cold. I wish it was like that, or I wish it was like that. And kind of, if you look carefully, what happens is the senses are saying cold. The senses are saying I'm used to entertainment. The senses, chushim, are saying this, that, and the other, many voices. And then we build a picture and we say, it's like that, it's cold. Today we were, you know, playing with sun and shade, and I gave that last night gave that example of the film of Nespa Milano. It's not like that. We make a story out of it, and then we inside the story. It's like we buy a nice suit from in the shop, and it doesn't quite fit, and we try and fit ourselves in it, and we forget then that we fitted ourselves in a suit that doesn't quite fit us. Clothes, jump, whatever. Livush. So we build a world out of what arises through the senses, and then forget that we built the world. We built that world, and we call it, it's cold, it's boring, it's, what am I doing here? It's like this, I'm full of anger, it doesn't work, this works, success, failure, I don't know, my life is crazy. We build stories. We build. But we forget that our capacity to be free inside experience, we forget our capacity to be a free person experiencing things which arrive, as Simi was saying, the guests, but a free person welcoming guests. I know it's not so easy, it's easy to say, but when a guest of anger comes, it's very hard to say, I'm a free person and anger is coming, knocking at the door and arriving. We say, you know, leave that stuff, I'm just angry. Okay. I know it's not so easy, but if you're looking for a direction, where is this taking us? It's our understanding that we are a free being, much bigger than we realize, much lighter and freer, experiencing pleasant, unpleasant things that knock at the door and come in. And we don't need to build a world around those experiences, like especially I am a victim, or it's no good, or everything's basa. Or it's all the opposite. Everything is cloud in the sky. Everything is rainbows. We don't need to. It's okay. It happens. We're human beings. But we need to look and see the way we do that. I suddenly, when I was thinking about this today, I suddenly remembered in India, when I was there in 1975, I was at the university teaching in Varanasi. 1975-76, and I had to get a TOFFS from Indian bureaucracy about income tax, and it had to have a stamp from a lawyer. So I said, where are the lawyers? Where are the Orchidin? Where are the lawyers sitting? They said, outside the court. So I went to the court in Varanasi, and there was a sea of little huts, but they were like little boxes made of wood, and each in each box, which was really small like that, was an Indian lawyer with a black cloak, whatever it is, black cloak thing, like a lawyer with a white thing there. But if you looked underneath his table, he was wearing a lungi. there wasn't anything there at all. It was just, you know, a pair of hairy legs that didn't have anything to do with being lawyers. And I was just, it was so funny, because we're like that. We wear suits, you know. If we wear clothes, but what's underneath? Are we, this clothes called my life is like this, or I'm a lawyer, or I'm this, or I suffer, or I'm a victim, or I'm a Jew, or I'm not a Jew. Whatever it is, they're clothes that we put on, and then we really believe it. And they can be like the clothes that a child wears on Purim, as a demon or a pirate. But underneath there's a small lovely child, a pirate, girl, you know, and the demon with big teeth. But what's underneath that? So we kind of we need to move to another place where we recognize and acknowledge our freedom inside all the roles and experiences of life. Visitors, you can call also appearances, things that appear, morphim, things appear. We didn't ask for viruses, they appear. We didn't ask for cold, for hot, for this, for that, they appear. Things appear in our world. When the Buddha awakened, the first principle that he gave out into the world was the Four Noble Truths, which are called noble because they are making us noble. They're not big truths. They're truths that if we practice them, they make us noble. They're not the kind of... He wasn't one of those guys that's saying, I have found the truth. And he taught practice. So that's what we're doing here. Anyway, the first of them is dukkha, suffering or difficulty. As in it is inescapable that once we're born in a body, there will be suffering. But some people, in misunderstanding that first truth, and think life is suffering. Life is not suffering. And it's important to understand it. The suffering is created in relationship to our experience. So this guy on a wheelchair, his relationship to what happened to him totally changed, and he came out of suffering. 2 years of suffering, yes, and then what happened? Relationship. The same body, the same in the wheelchair, everything the same, but something shifted totally. It's not in life, suffering. Life is just life. Life doesn't want, you know, up there, someone up there saying, you, I want you to suffer, and you, I want you to be happy. Life is just life. Of course things happen, and we're not in control. And we don't like to be not in control. We want to be in control. We want to shut down that uncertainty. But suffering is created in relationship to. And therefore, if we understand that, and we're practicing it here, if we understand that, we'll begin to understand that we have a lot of options. Anger can arise, but we have a lot of possibilities what to do with it. It's an emotion, yes. It's an experience, yes. It comes from triggers, yes. Things happen, yes. There is our history and our memory and our buttons that we've got, yes. But still, anger arises as a response to a situation, and we are much more free look at it, to be with it, to understand it, to watch it as it arises, to see when it stops, to see that the anger is a response and a relationship to something. And then we begin to be more free and not in automatic pilot. Every time we watch, I don't know what, the politicians, I don't want to say Israel, but let's say Israel or in England, same, we get automatically angry. It's not me, it's them. But anger comes and goes. It's an appearance. It's a visitor. If I ask you now, this minute, please be really angry. Who can do that? You can't. It doesn't come by an order in a restaurant. I'll have a cup of coffee with 2 spoons of anger. Anger comes because the conditions arise, that we're not in control of them, someone says something, or we get frustrated, or something happens to us, and anger comes. The whole thing arises. Then what is up? What can we do? Are we on automatic? Tayas automati? Or is there a free person experiencing anger? And then many things can happen, not just the automatic. So I want to a little bit link that to what we're doing here. What we're doing here is, okay, you can say, it all sounds very nice, what you hear from the Bama right now, it has a logic to it, but what's it got to do with me watching my breath? How does that fit into any of that? Watching my breath is not psychological, it's not dealing with things, it's not, it just seems a little bit, kind of, how does it fit? I'll give you another example which I found really interesting in answer to this issue. We did many weekends over years, first with people with cancer, and then later on with elderly people. Groups, maybe 40 or so, who were, or mostly above 70, whatever, going to a weekend just like we're doing here. A lot of it was in other places like Kibbutz Yechia and so on. And they came with so loaded with so much load. The medical world is so bad for us, and we don't get respect, and we get pushed out, and our children, our grandchildren, just use us and want to take us all the money. There's so many complaints and so much, and the doctors don't listen. They just give us pills to shut us up, and they came with loaded with. And we say, okay, we listen. We had circles, and quite a few circles. It wasn't in total silence. But we kept saying, okay, let's now go outside and sit in a circle under the trees. And let's have 15 minutes where we just listen to the birds. And let's have 10 minutes where we just sit quietly, or half an hour with some guidance on breathing and coming back to our body. And slowly, slowly they understood, wait a minute. If I can breathe and connect with my breath, I'm not a 70-year-old breath. It's just the body breathing. It's not a 70-year-old body just a breath. It's just sitting. It's just the birds. It's just a tree above. It's just the shade of sitting on the grass. It's just this moment. So kind of inviting another way of looking opens possibilities, another way of knowing things, which is less construction, less wearing the livush, the clothes of what that we build and we wear, and it's like direct knowing. So what we are doing here is in a way cutting through the tendency to build a construction about life and then get inside it and feel in prison. Instead of that, we say, okay, what's really happening? Direct knowing, bli tivuch, right now, what's happening? And right now, what's really happening? With less assumptions, and less constructions, and less interpretations. Much more left brain, right brain, I would say, between the two. It's looking at the details. There is a breath, and there is a body, and there are the hands, and there is the sound, and there is the touch of the air on our face, and, you know, details. And looking at a bigger picture. Here I am sitting. Here I am walking under the sky, on the earth. So it's much more sensing than kind of another busyness with concepts about and summaries about. And through this intimacy, a knowing that's more direct, we begin to see a little bit more the truth of things, rather than the way we interpret them, or the constructions we make around them, or the summaries, like I said. Satya, truth. Firstly, one important truth is we call an experience. That's already clarity. It's an experience. That's the beginning of taking responsibility for it. I'm experiencing anger is different from I'm angry. Anger is happening and I see it is different from I'm angry, it's them. So we, okay, the experience of being bored, some of you said today or yesterday. It's an experience of being bored. I talked about my grandchildren having that experience. It's an experience. Okay, so that's the beginning of something, a different way of looking at it. We can turn to it, we can begin to witness this experience of boredom. What is it like? Instead of just being bored and fed up, what's it like, this experience? How is it? What am I doing with it? What am I building out of it? What buttons is it pressing? What it makes me do? Often blame. That's the next stage. It often, you know, blame ourselves, blame something, blame the fact that we're sitting 45 minutes, whatever, doesn't matter. Thoughts. We label, I have bothering thoughts, unpleasant thoughts, disturbing thoughts, there are too many thoughts, I can't shut them down. But wait a minute. They're visitors also. They knock at the door and want to come in. A thought is an experience. Can we be a witness to that? And again, we find ourselves freer to be with thought rather than automatically being under it and controlled by thought and fighting thought. Thought is happening, like breath is happening, sound of the air conditioner is happening, my voice is happening. So it helps us to go into the present moment experience. Experience is always in the now. It can't be anywhere else. We can't experience breath that was or that will be. We can't experience a thought that was. Even a memory is an experience of in the now. The memory appears now. Experience is always in the now. The closer we are to the now, the nowness, the presence, the more we will find ourselves much freer to be with our experience. Because the constructions about what will be or what was and what they're often with time take us out of that place. So what we're practicing here is a way of looking, a way of knowing, a way of sensing our life, which is different and immediate and intimate. From there, things happen. So we're learning something here, a way of seeing. And that's why we're sitting 45 minutes with the breath, if you like. We're learning another way of seeing our life, of meeting our life. And it allows things to happen. A lot of it is about control, and it's a big issue. We want control, not only us, but every creature wants somehow to be in control. Life doesn't give us that give us that present, and maybe thankfully. But it's very helpful to know that, okay, life is sort of, things arrive that I don't like or I do like, and I'm not in control. I can't be in charge of what life brings. We talked about that before as a kind of allowing things or accepting things or being with things as they are. A helpful attitude in our practice. It helps, it increases the power of this practice. I want to see what is fully there with what is arising right now, and let go a bit of this sense that I have to control everything, I have to improve everything, I have to deal with things. Then we can deal with things. It's not that the Buddha didn't take medicines. Of course he did, and all of us deal with things, but how do we do that? Again, a free person taking whatever, a medicine, or a wonderful lunch that we're all having here. Some time back, 2 or 3 months ago, I was invited in unexpectedly to give a talk to 200 doctors, actually specialists. They were pain specialists, and it was in a meeting of the neurologist and pain specialists, or the Israel Society of Pain, and maybe you were there. I don't know. Maybe some of you were there. I don't know. But I happened to be in the area that time. It was near Kiryat Shmona, so I said, oh, okay, I'm going to go there, and I did the talk. And I gave a story of somebody that was years and years and years ago. I had a group in Akko, in the college there, that Galil Maravi College, and we were practicing every week, and I was giving guidance and giving. And one day there was like half an hour, there was some guidance, and then 10, 15 minutes, there was quiet. And then a woman started to burst into tears. And she cried and she cried and she cried. After 10, 15 minutes, the end of the sitting, we all asked her. It was, by the way, a lovely class, because there were Druze and there were Arabs from Shfaram, and there were people from the kibbutzim. It was a really mixed group. And people say, why are you crying? What happened? What happened? And she said, I've had pain in my hip that has been really strong for the last 15, 20 years since the birth of my children. And I'm only taking pills, and I feel quite helpless. I go to the doctor and get more pills and more pills. And then everybody around me, my family, treat me as a slave. They want meals, they want looked after. I have to clean the house, I have to serve the children, I have to serve my husband. I'm a slave, I'm nobody. And I have to take pills, and I'm in pain all the time. And she said, all of a sudden, I was doing what you suggest, which is becoming intimate with the experience of pain, getting close, looking at it with kindness, touching it with awareness, touching inside. And all of a sudden, the pain disappeared. It came back. But all of a sudden, I realized that through my power of awareness, I could change that pain. It became workable in a way I hadn't imagined. And if that pain, which is so strong and been with me 20 years, I can work with it, then all of a sudden I realized I have much more power than I knew, and I can do the same with my whole life. And it sort of touched her deeply, and she felt the empowerment of being able to look directly at her experience as a witness, a free person, different kind of knowing, getting close to it. And I gave that example to the doctors because my question to the doctors was, is your treatment that you give to pain, people suffering from pain, is it empowering them or is it not? Are your patients being empowered or disempowered? I didn't give a kaze shtifat moach, Buddhisti, but I did ask one or two questions of this kind, and which I felt were relevant. Because there is a, you know, cultural thing. People come to with pain and give pills. So, how does this all work? Into what's the kind of understanding? What happened to this woman, to her pain? What is it that? Why did her pain suddenly disappear when she looked at it? What's going on? Well, one of the understandings that arise from our meeting with our genuine experience is that everything that we meet has a very short shelf life. Chaye madaf. Everything that we meet is changing, it passes. It's not there forever. The anger that we really annoys us, how long does it last? The boredom that we felt yesterday, do we still have it today? Everything moves, everything passes, everything changes. And we can't hold on to things even if we want to. And she discovered that her pain wasn't a thing, kind of a gush, a permanent, solid thing called pain. She built a story around that. My pain, I'm a victim, I'm a patient, a constant. But actually, in the intimate connection with that place of pain, it comes, it goes, it says something, it disappears, then it's there, then it's here, then it moves, and then yes, take a pill. Then what happens? How are you with that? What's the story? What happens in life? And so on. It's a dynamic. The last words of the Buddha, as he was dying, he said one famous sentence, which is translated to English as, all compounded things are impermanent, meaning all constructions are impermanent, are passing. And it's quite freeing. Because, for example, a label we have on ourselves, I am this. If we look at it as an experience, it no longer sticks. Right now, that's my label. I am Stephen is a label. I am 75 is a label. Where is it? How is it? Is it here? Where is it? It's a label comes and goes. It has a limited validity. It doesn't have an ultimate truth to it. It's just a thought or experience. And same with everything. Conditions change, cloud, sun. Cloud, cold, warm. Everything moves. A thought moves. Oh, my thoughts are so difficult, they're problematic, they have such a burden, they're so disturbing, they go round and round and round. Wait a minute. This thought right now, is it, how long is it there? And you'll say, oh, that was, it's gone. There was a thought. And it liberates itself. A thought frees itself like a bubble. There are many traditional images of this, like small bubbles after the rain. That's what thoughts are like. If we look closely, if we look directly, we don't need to read philosophy books about that. We need to see it, that's the thought. A thought arises like a bubble after the rain, and boop, it's gone straight away. And it doesn't matter whether it's a difficult thought or a beautiful thought. It still goes. I love that line by William Blake, who says, kiss the joy as it flies, and you'll live in eternity's sunrise. Like, kiss the joy as it flies. Don't hang on to the joy. I must have it. kiss it as it flies by. Kiss your thoughts as they fly by. And it really helps us to see things fresh and new and original. We learn something about reality that way. We learn satya, the truth of things. This breath comes and goes. This movement of the hands comes and goes. Every moment is fresh and new. We don't breathe in the past. We don't breathe in the future. We don't think in the past or the future. Everything arises in the now. And our intimacy with that opens a whole field of inspiration and contact and freedom. Sometimes, of course, we want to hold on to something that we like. I don't want this great lunch to disappear. I want to eat more of it. Secondly, satya, the truth of things, does tell us that we can't ignore difficult experiences like this experience of pain. It shows us where we need to look. So here pain is useful because it shows us where we need to look. The voices of our conditioning, hatnaya, the voices of the giving us trouble, what are they? They tell us where we need to go. They are the compass that says, go here, because there's a journey, a liberating journey, go there. And I think in the instructions this morning you had some suggestions about take those places, those voices seriously. Go there, let them invite you to look. The voices of doubt or of desire, of aversion, or of resistance, or anger, or they're inviting you. There's your windows. Also, a sense of there's a place to clean things, a little bit to clean them. And a very important aspect of this is non-identification. We talked about it in different language, but it's really important. An experience is just an experience. It arises, it appears, it's a phenomena. We don't need to say, I am this or I am that. It's just appearing. Conditions happen and anger happens. We can go there, I am angry. But we can also sense, okay, conditions such as someone being rude to us and anger arises. So if we let go a little bit of the identification, ihizdahut is the key to this practice. We are made of all kinds of voices in us. When we look carefully, who are we? There's so many people inside each of us. We're so many voices. We're like a kaleidoscope of thoughts and of history and of this and of labels and of things that we think about ourselves. Who are we? There's something there that's important. So, this practice, what we're doing here, the intimacy with our lived moment, our genuine experience in the now, will gradually give us more space in the consciousness instead of the constructions or taking away from the investment in constructions this is life, this is it, this is who I am, this is the world, the constructions we make, we still have them, but they get a little lighter all the time, and instead there is a space of awareness and a space of freedom in which we can receive what happens. There's more sense of spaciousness. And that's what this practice is helping us. It's not going to just weekend meditation retreat. It's not going to kind of turn us into angels all of a sudden. Well, it might do. But we'll still be human beings, and we'll still get angry and a bit pissed off, and this will happen and that, and we'll get cold, and you know, all of that will happen. But we can watch how there is, when we kind of keep practicing, there's more space with which to receive experience and hold it with our with awareness, with not just awareness, technical awareness, but kind awareness, caring awareness. Our relationship to our experience changes. At the same time, things may be becoming a little less defined, a little less determined. We may be, we go with the openness, there's a sense of ready for anything, allowing surprises too. So the when we meet our daily life, it changes. And what happens underneath is slowly, slowly, everything takes on more meaning. Instead of reading 20 books, philosophies, psychology, endless, I mean, I shouldn't say much against books because I've written so many books. But let's say, besides them, but we begin to discover meaning in this moment, which doesn't need any books. And meaning arises. This moment is meaningful. This is the only moment that we live. This moment of listening, this moment of sitting, this moment of moving our body, this moment of the air and the space and presence that we all hear together. The definition of wisdom in the Dharma is profound suchness, deep suchness. Suchness you could call kahut, maybe, nowness. Deep nowness of things that just arise and they open and like a flower. And so we live differently. And we can experience it here as we sit, as we walk, as we pay attention to what's happening, whether pleasant or unpleasant. Caring attention. That's actually the last word of the Buddha. After all compounded things are impermanent, he said, practice appamada. And appamada is caring attention. Pay attention with care to what's really happening in this moment. That were the final words. And then he went off. So I'll go off. We'll have a few minutes of quiet now.